Good morning, Denver. Welcome to Power Players. Thanks for joining us this morning. I've got with me today Craig DiMartino. Good morning, Craig. How are you?
Oh, very good, Ken. Thank you for having me here.
Now, for the listeners who don't recognize your name immediately, though probably in Colorado there's a lot of them that do, you are a internationally known rock climber.
Right.
And a free climber at that.
Right. Mostly mostly roped free climbing here in the lower 48 and kind of all around the world. I've been fortunate enough to travel pretty extensively and climb and just really enjoy being outside.
Awesome. Well, explain to us, before we get into all this, explain to us what free climbing means.
Okay. Free climbing is using a rope and harness and protection that's made to go into the rock, into the cracks in the rock, into the fractures in the rock, that if you fall, you're on a rope and you fall to your last piece of protection, and that way you're not, you know, obviously falling all the way to the ground. It's just a great way to go out, ascend up a rock face, take the gear, put the gear in, and then take the gear out as you're going and leave no trace, and you can climb really wherever you want.
Now, you live here in Colorado. Did you pick this place because of rock climbing, or did you rock climb because of this place?
I did. I actually grew up in Philadelphia, which, hard to believe, there's not a lot of climbing in Philadelphia. So I had gone out to Yosemite. I started climbing in Philadelphia at a bachelor party, of all things, and met some great guys there, and then really kind of took off with it and went to Yosemite on a road trip about 3 years into climbing and saw the West and thought, oh, this is incredible. So came back through Colorado to visit an old friend of mine from high school and junior high school, and just fell in love with the place and moved out here to climb more.
Okay. And now you're also married to Cindy?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I met Cindy in Philadelphia, actually. She's also from Philadelphia, and that's kind of one of those cool where you kind of don't see God working, but then you look back 20 years later and you go, oh, wow, that was kind of cool. She came into the climbing gym where I was working. I went in to pick up my check the last day before I was moving to Colorado, and she was there, and we exchanged phone numbers and met out here. She was going to Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and I was moving to Loveland, which is a town kind of right next door to Fort Collins, and we met and climbed together and then got engaged and got married.
Wow, so you think God had anything to do with that?
No, yeah. Boy, that's a stretch. I don't know. Yeah, it's pretty amazing just the way you kind of look back and see how things got put together and things you could have never planned. You know, it's just amazing to me.
Oh, yeah, man. I've got one of those stories, too, but that's for another day. Well, I'll tell you, let's talk about, there are a couple things. All my listeners know that the reason that we have you on the program is because that you've got an amazing story that gives some great glory to God, and that you are now in a position where you serve the Lord in a very special way, and it's a result of rock climbing. So I'm gonna be quiet for a minute. I'm going to kind of let you take over and tell us what put you in the place you're at now, what happened, and when that happened. It sounds like it was in 2002, right?
Yeah, pretty much July in Colorado is just a gorgeous time of year to be climbing outside. And with Cindy and I both climbing and our young kids, also climbing for us was a pretty much regular event. So around 8 o'clock that day, my partner Steve picked me up and we were going to head up to Rocky Mountain National Park, which is about 30 minutes from my house. And we did. We drove up to the canyon, got out and hiked in, and we decided to go out to Sundance Buttress, which is the last tower on a long, kind of long line of towers and these cool domes up at Lumpy Ridge, which is near Estes Park. And I had never climbed out there. Steve had climbed out there several times, and he had a route picked out. So we kind of hoofed it back there. It's about 4.5 miles in. Beautiful day, nobody out, so we kind of were out there all by ourselves, and we roped up and started up a climb. And we were about halfway up the climb through a group of large overhangs kind of that go about midway up the rock. And as I got to the anchor on about the third pitch, which is about 300 feet up in the air, it started to get really windy, really cloudy, and, you know, just started, the sky just opened up with rain and then grapple and then hail, and the temperature dropped, and, you know, here I am huddled under this roof waiting for Steve to get up to me, and he gets up to me, and we were looking up, and again, like I said, we were about halfway up, and we decided, well, going up would probably be a little bit dangerous with the water, but going down, we'd probably be quicker and get out of the weather. So we started to rig the ropes for rappel and got set up and rappelled down. It took us about a half hour to get down. Pretty much typical Colorado weather, you know, we got down and 5 seconds later the sun came out, the rain stopped, the hail stopped, and it started to get warm again. So we kind of laughed a little bit, looked at our watches. It was right around noon, so we decided, well, let's eat a little bit of food. And because he had climbed out there before, he knew of some climbs up the way a little bit, and we decided to go up and just see if they had dried off and see if they would be climbable. So we ate, walked up the cliff a little bit, and there the climbs were, and they were amazingly dry. So we decided, well, let's get on these, and then we'll take off and go home. So I tied into a climb called White Man, which is about 100. The first pitch, which is about 100 feet long, ended on a ledge. And Steve had climbed it before and told me it was really, you know, quite interesting. So I thought, yeah, this would be fun, tied in, got my rack together, started up the climb, and, you know, 100 feet later, the climb went really well. It wasn't physically, it was a hard climb, but it was more of a mental climb. A lot of climbs up in the park, the gear, you have to really think about how you're putting gear in. There might be long stretches of where you don't have any gear, so you kind of have to put some stuff in. They call it running it out when you're climbing. So you run it out a little bit, and then you get some more good gear, and then you keep going. So mentally, it kind of works on your brain a little bit. But, you know, got up to the ledge. Everything was great. And the anchors on that ledge, in particular, were two large bolts that were driven into the rock by the first Ascensionist party. And they had some webbing on it. And the webbing, just from sitting out in the sun, the roof doesn't get that much traffic. And so from sitting out in the sun, they were a little bit dried out and cracked. So some of it I could move away, and I did that and kind of cleared up the anchor, clipped into the anchor, and then yelled down to Steve that I was off belay. And climbing, much like any sport, has its own vernacular, and off belay means to the other climber that I'm safe and that I'm clipped in and that he can stop watching me. And he's using something called a belay device, which the rope is running through, that if I fall, it stops my fall. He arrests the fall. And so Steve, hearing me say off belay, he unclipped completely from the rope, which is totally normal, walked about 20 feet over to where his backpack was because he didn't have his shoes on yet and was going to get his shoes on. So I'm up on the ledge, you know, 100 feet above him, kind of undoing my anchor, making it safe, because as we had walked up to the climb, Steve and I were talking about what we were going to do, and we had said, let's top rope this climb. So, again, part of that climber vernacular, top roping, in my world, was I would climb the route, Steve would lower me to the ground, and then I would belay him from the ground as he climbed the route. Steve thought, okay, Craig's going to climb the route, he's going to get to that anchor, then he's going to bring the rest of the rope up, and then I'm going to come up there, and we're going to rappel off that ledge together. And that small, very small miscommunication was something that started this whole event in motion. So I clean the anchor up, run my rope through the anchor, and then tie back into it. And I yell down to Steve and say, okay, Steve, it's all you, which from us climbing together was one of our commands that just meant, okay, I'm ready to be lowered. So Steve said, okay, and was putting his shoes on thinking, okay, Craig's ready for me to come up there to the ledge. Well, when he said, okay, Craig, I heard okay, and I thought, well, and unclip and now get lowered down. So I unclipped from the anchor, leaned back on the rope, and just started falling. And Steve, being 20 feet away, saw me come off the ledge and starts to run to get to the base of the cliff to try to, I mean, at that point, grabbing the rope would have been extremely bad on his part. It just would have tore his hands apart. And I'm going, and from climbing outside so much and for so long, when you come off of a route, I've been dropped before, but not obviously nowhere near this far. You kick out to kind of see where you're going, because when you boulder a lot outside, which is climbing without a rope, but you only climb as high as you feel comfortable falling. Right. When you come off, you always turn to look because you want to see where you're going to land so you don't break your ankles. And I did that. I kicked out, turned. That's the last thing I remember, is just seeing the hillside going away from me. And the next thing I remember, I was looking up at the cliff that I had just climbed, and Steve was above me, you know, shouting at me. And I really was confused. I had no idea what happened. I was just sitting there, and he's yelling, and I must have been unconscious for about 2 or 3 seconds once I hit the ground, and then I was back. The weird thing is, and this is where, you know, the hand of God, if you cannot see the hand of God in this as this accident goes, it's just incredible to me that people can actually not see it, but I'm amazed. As I came off, I kicked and turned, and that kick started to tip me backwards off the cliff. So as I was falling, what was happening was I was falling basically laying down. If I had hit the ground that way, after talking with doctors and other trauma folks, there's no way you can survive a fall from that far laying down.
Right.
But about 15 feet from the ground, there was a dead tree that stood up, and I came down and just brushed right through it, and it stood me back up perfectly straight. And when I hit the ground, I landed basically standing up but leaning slightly back on my heels. And the good side to that was, you know, I landed standing up, which is good. The bad side to that was I landed standing up, which means my feet just exploded.
Right.
And then the shockwave, you don't stop right away when you hit the ground. It's you know, physics in action. So when you hit the ground, it takes a little while for all that energy to dissipate, and it has to go out somewhere. So it basically just travels right up your body like a shockwave in an earthquake, and it snapped my feet, you know, just pulverized them, broke my back right around L2, and then just broke my neck, and then just went right up the top of me, and I crumpled down onto the talus, which was probably rocks about the size of a dishwasher in your house. And, you know, I'm laying there, and Steve's talking to me and yelling at me and trying to explain to me what happened, and I'm obviously out of it, and he pulls me. Now, keep in mind, my back is broken so badly, your L2 vertebrae, I didn't even have it anymore. They said it powdered into nothing.
Right.
He drags me down off these talus blocks, which should have paralyzed me right there, and to get me into some dirt so that I could lay a little bit more comfortably, because what Steve was realizing was, okay, we're 4.5 miles into the backcountry. There's nobody here. I have to go to the trailhead and then drive into Estes Park and get help. So he makes me as comfortable as he can, gets me, you know, gets the bleeding controlled on my leg because I had tore, when I smashed my feet open, I had cut arteries on my right foot. He put a tourniquet on that leg and said, okay, I'm going to go. And he, you know, you just stay here, don't die, and I'm going to do the best I can. And he just takes off. So I'm laying there, and he gets about 20 feet down the trail and realizes, wait, he turns, comes back up. He had packed his cell phone as an afterthought that morning. And he's come for 17 years at that time, and he never carried a cell phone, but for some reason threw it in his pack that day. Comes back up, turns it on, and we're right next to a 1,000-foot cliff in Estes Park, which is just notorious for eating up cell phones. And he gets a perfect signal and dials 911, and boom, he gets the 911 operator, and she starts to ask what happened. He gives the nature of the emergency, and she says, okay, just don't panic, but don't move. I'm going to put you through to Rocky Mountain Rescue. And she does that, and she gets Eric Gabriel, who is the head of Rocky Mountain Rescue and also a climber, on the line, and he says, you know, okay, where are you? Steve tells him, not only does Eric know the climb that we're at, but about, I think it was almost exactly a year ago, a gentleman had been coming down the descent gully next to me and fell and ended up dying. But what happened was Eric and the rescue team had been up there and had evacuated him, and so Eric knew exactly where I was laying. He knew exactly the lowering out positions and where to put the gurney, where to put the belay anchors, and how many people he would need. So he got on the horn right away, all the while driving, gets in, comes through McGregor Ranch, and takes a shortcut up to where we are. And within 45 minutes after what should have been a fatal fall, I have a trained EMT next to me. And he's starting to, you know, go through my injuries and treat me and see what's going on. About 10 minutes later, another ranger, Bill Alexander, who's also a trained EMT, was there. So within an hour, 4.5 miles into the backcountry, way up on the side of a cliff, I have two trained guys who are working on me already. Now, obviously, to get me out and to fly me to wherever they're going to take me is going to be quite an effort, because we're up on the side of the cliff. They have to lower me down these slabs of granite to get me to a trail that, when they can put a wheel on the litter, then they can wheel me out to a clearing where the helicopter can land. But I fell at 2:30 in the afternoon. Even under the best circumstances, you know, you're going to trim that pretty close with darkness. That the helicopter won't come in to the canyon because of sight. In the dark, and so they said, you know, here's your cutoff. You have, you know, roughly 5 hours, so you guys got to get it done. So they, you know, through an incredible orchestrated effort, got me lowered down, got me out to the clearing, and they said, you know, the chopper pilot said, you made it probably with about 10 to 20 minutes to spare.
Wow.
Get me loaded into the helicopter, and then, you know, like I said, and it's kind of cool that Eric, who's the first guy next to my side, Steve's been interviewed many times and has said, and Steve, not being a believer, is very, very weird dynamic sometimes, but he said, you know, Eric, when he came up the trail, was like an angel when he appeared, because he said, you know, here's this guy who's going to help us. And he said the cool thing about Eric is his last name is Gabriel. And Steve's never seen that weirdness. I told him that, and he was like, wow, that's different. But to me, it's like, yeah, you know, God has just stepped in from the minute I came off that ledge, you know, and he's sitting here next to me today as I talk to you. It's just been so amazing how he's taken care of us and gotten the right people next to me at the time they needed to be there to get me to where I needed to be. So
wow.
They got me to the chopper, and the chopper then flew me into Poudre Valley Hospital in Fort Collins.
Wow. And you know what? I sit here and I'm at a loss for words. Wow is about all I can say. And the thing is this, I mean, there's so much more. And we are going to break real quick to identify our sponsor, but we're going to come back because this gets even more exciting.
That sounds great.
And exciting doesn't necessarily always mean great, but I mean, it gets more exciting because it is the rest of the story is awesome.
Yeah, I agree.
So we'll be back on the other side of a break, and we'll identify a sponsor. We'll continue with this in just a moment.
94.7 KRKS.
At JFR & Associates, experience a refreshing way to purchase or lease your next vehicle. A professional and courteous member of their team can save you the hassles of typical automotive shopping. They'll do the work and save you time and money. The trained consultants at JFR will search for your next new or pre-owned vehicle, and they have all types of financing available for any credit situation. Their consultants can discuss leasing or financing options with you. At JFR & Associates, they are proud of their reputation, and their repeat and referral clients all agree. Purchasing your next vehicle can be a surprisingly pleasant experience. Call JFR & Associates today for all of your automotive needs. Call 1-888-963-2289 or visit their website, www.jfrcars.com. Call JFR & Associates today for all of your automotive needs. Call 1-888-963-2289. That's 1-888-963-2289. Call today.
All right, Denver. Well, welcome back to Power Players. We are in the midst of, you're probably on a clincher right now because we're in the middle of a really exciting story, a testimony from Craig DiMartino, free climber, who just got through, if you're just joining us, telling us about this incredible fall that he had and the amazing way that God put people in place to get you out of that situation, Craig. And then we're going to pick up where that goes. I do want to point out, right before we start, we'll point it out again, is that people can find out more about you and what you've got going on if they go to afterthefallministry.com. Everyone understands www, so afterthefallministry.com. I want to make sure people check that out, and they can always get onto our website as well at powerplayersradio.com, and they'll be linked up there as well. But, Craig, so continue. Where we left off on the other side of the break, they got you out of the canyon in just the nick of time, literally.
Right. And they, Flight for Life, you know, took me into Fort Collins. My wife, about halfway through the evacuation, Steve said to the head ranger, Eric, he said, you know, should I call his wife? And Eric looked at me and he said, you know what? I don't think he's going to live. So, yeah, you probably should call her. And I have seen Eric interviewed, and Eric and I have talked, and he said, you know, I figured you were going to die by the time we got you to the helicopter. And he said, if it was me, I would want my wife to be there. So he said, yeah, you should call her. So he called Cindy on his cell phone, and Cindy was at home, and he said, you know, Craig fell, but he smashed his ankles up. And he fell 100 feet. But he didn't say, Craig fell and hit the ground. He just said he fell and broke his ankle. So Cindy thought, okay, you know, that's bad, but it's not that bad. And the day before this climb, Cindy had run a ultra marathon up in Leadville. So she had run 31 miles through the mountains, and she was so sore the next day when she got up. And when I went climbing, she was just kind of hobbling around the kitchen. And she said, you know, the ultimate cure for soreness after a run was getting a call that your husband just took a digger. And she said, she drove up and ran in the 4.5 miles and got to us in just incredible time. She said, I didn't even feel my muscles. She said, I don't even remember running. I just went. She got there. Eric said, you know, he's pretty bad. We're going to get him to the chopper and do everything we can. They got me to the chopper, flew me in the Poudre Valley, and when they got in, Cindy got there. The doctor came out and said, look, you know, we're going to give him about an hour. We're going to try everything we can, but he's pretty bad. His feet are destroyed. His back is broken terribly. His neck is broken terribly. I punctured my left lung. I had a huge hematoma on my chest. My whole chest was just enveloped in blood, as well as my liver, and just from the compression injuries. And they said, you know, we're going to do everything we can, but here's the paperwork you need to do now. Do you want us to resuscitate him? Do you want us to do, because I couldn't breathe on my own. She had to sit in this lobby and go through all this stuff, and you know, I can't even imagine that feeling. Docs went back in, kept working, came back out and said, you know, he's starting to respond. Worked on me for many, many hours. They had to go in and pick off all the debris from the vertebrae that I had exploded. They had to pick it off with tweezers because when it touches your spinal cord, that's what causes paralysis. So any spot that it touches is now ruined. So I had all this stuff sprayed all over my spine. So they had to pick all that off. That took several hours. And then they took some bone from my hip and went in there, built me a new vertebrae out of that, and then fused it all together with two titanium rods that are about 3 or 3.5 inches long, and I have 6 screws that hold that all together now, like in a cage. Then they said, okay, we're going to stop there and let them try to work on his feet a little. So they brought in an orthopedic surgeon who starts to work on my feet. He realizes, wow, you know, we can't save these even. So he said, what we'll do is we'll just wrap them, put him in ICU until he can breathe, if he breathes, and then we're going to have to amputate those probably the end of the week. So they did that. They kind of got me stable, got me back to ICU. I was in critical condition for about 3 days on a ventilator. No idea what was going on. You know, when I woke up, the first person I was looking at was my spinal surgeon. And he just looked at me, and he was real calm. I couldn't talk. And he just said, you know, you were in a really bad accident, and you're in the hospital, and we're going to take care of you. And that's all he said. And that's all I needed to hear at that point.
Right.
Didn't want to know specifics probably anyway. So, you know, the days kind of melded together. I really didn't know what was going on. I know Cindy came in. We communicated as much as we could. And, you know, those days kind of went by. Then about the third day, they decided, okay, they tie you down because you have so many wires in you and cords and everything. And they finally decided to untie me so I could move my hands. And they had figured since I had destroyed my spine so badly, your spine, if you picture a diameter of 100%, I had compressed it 90%. So only about 10% of it was open. They figured, okay, they told, you know, my parents and Cindy that, you know, he's going to be a paraplegic. He's not going to be able to walk. He's going to have a lot of, paralysis below his waist. And just so you know, that's all coming. And, by the way, we're probably going to have to amputate those feet. We'll see what happens. About the third or fourth day, my orthopedic came back in, and he said, okay, let's go in there and take a look at those feet. And they went in, And he said, you know, let's see what we can do. And he just started being very creative with bone cement and screws and plates, and he started putting stuff back together and saving both my feet. Said, you know, the right one is going to be really sketchy. We're not sure how that's going to work. The left one, we can save that one. It's going to be really screwed up. He'll have to wear braces on it, but, you know, he'll be able to put pressure on it. So he went in and did some amazing work down there, and then, you know, the next day they took me off the breather, and I slowly, you know, started to gain a little bit of momentum and moving forward. They're real careful about what they tell you when you're in intensive care, and so I wasn't sure what was going on, and one day I woke up, and there was a nurse there who was always there, and she was just a super great lady, and I thought, you know, I'm going to try to find out what the heck's wrong with my feet. So I made the motion, you know, where you take your fingers and walk.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, she said, your feet are really busted up bad. We don't know, you know, what's going to happen to them. But when I made that motion, she started to cry, and I thought, oh, boy, why is she crying?
Yeah.
And she looks at me, and she said, you know, we don't really know if you're going to be able to walk anymore. Hmm. And I'm laying there thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm 34 years old. What is this lady saying? And it totally freaked me out. And she, you know, kind of gets herself together, tells me everything's going to be okay, and she leaves. But now I'm laying there by myself going, oh, man, what is going on? And just kind of shocked me enough to scare me and made me go, okay, I need to really focus and pay attention on whatever is going on now. So they kept slowly working on me. They operated on my feet several times. And then around 7 days, 6 or 7 days, they moved me out of intensive care into just the orthopedic unit, which is, you know, just right down the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there, they operated on me again. I ended up doing 5 surgeries while I was there. After about 2 weeks, they said, okay, we're going to move you to a rehabilitation center. They moved me there. Still had never walked. Still, that was kind of up in the air. They didn't say, yeah, you're going to walk, or no, you're not. They wouldn't tell me anything. And they were doing these little pinwheel exercises on my toes and feet where they would run this spiked little pinwheel up and down. And you close your eyes and you tell them where it is. And every day they would do that. I would never obviously know where it was. And,
right.
And that just, that would, I would dread when they would come in with this thing because I'm like, oh, gosh, you know. And then there's that part of you that goes, well, I'm going to lie and tell them they're on my left foot. But
right.
Then you're wrong, and then you look like an idiot. So
right.
You're just like, oh, gosh. So that kind of kept going and going and going. And the paralysis, they were trying to figure out where the paralysis was and what it was doing. And you know, I could slowly move my feet, but I couldn't move them real well. And they just kind of did what they wanted to do. So I kind of, you know, they kept working on me, and they said, okay, we're going to start doing some PT now and see if we can get you out of bed. Because up until that point, my back was fused, they had to lower me in and out of bed with a crane.
Wow.
And that went on for about a month. And, you know, that just, I wanted to get moving again. And they, you know, they would, you know, they want to be cautious and not do anything stupid. So slowly but surely started to kind of work my way out of that. And then just one day decided, okay, you know, I think we should maybe try walking, you know, on crutches
yeah.
or something. And they, you know, we talked about it, tried to figure it all out. And through this whole process, you know, people are coming to see me, and I'm just kind of, literally, you live an hour at a time. You don't live, I couldn't even project the end of the afternoon for you. I would just think, okay, I'm going to go through this, whatever they're doing right now, and that's it.
Right.
And I would pray a ton. I would get huge amounts of, you know, just books and letters and support from people. And the thing that just humbled me completely was, you know, I was in prayer chains all over the world where
yeah.
people I'd never met, you know, just were praying for me, were praying for my family. Cindy would come with the kids every day, and we would, you know, chat and talk and, you know, and I, like I said, I wouldn't know what to do, but I knew things were going to change, and just kept praying and praying. And one day I just was laying there by myself and opened up a book a friend of mine sent me, and it was a daily devotional book by Max Licato, which I typically don't read those.
Right.
And I thought, oh, let's see what it is on the 21st, the day I fell, and I flipped over to it, and the intro title said, how far does God have to go to get your attention?
Wow.
And I was like, oh, man, what's that?
Yeah.
And, so I'm reading it, and basically what it was just scripture references saying, you know, what does God need to do to be first in your life, and what does he need to do to help you do that? And I'm sitting there going, oh, man, okay. So, you know, I close the book, and I'm thinking, okay. And I just start praying, and I said, you know, God, whatever you want to do, I'm going to listen. You know, you got my attention. It's completely undivided. Trust me, I'm not thinking of anything else. Whatever you want me to do, just please make it clear, and we'll try to do everything we can. To whatever you want us to do and follow that. And so after the fall ministries then came from that, which then kind of dovetailed into us, both Cindy and myself, we'll go out and we'll speak to churches and business groups and small groups and just kind of tell them, this is what God's doing in our life, and this is how we're using something that was a bad deal that turned into something that's just amazing. You know,
right.
People ask me all the time, you know, if you could take it back, would you take it back? And initially, you know, that first year I probably said yes quite a bit. But now, you, being able to look back at it, I go, no, you know, I don't think I would, because it's given me such an amazing overview of my life and slowed me down and allowed me to look back and meet these incredible people who I work with and get to talk to, and I've seen what God's done with it, and it's just been an amazing journey.
Well, I'll tell you, it's just to listen to you. I mean, we could go on. We are coming to the very close of the show, and I do want to make sure that I point people again to your website, because there's much more to this story. And people need to visit afterthefallministry.com. Please visit afterthefallministry.com, because we didn't get into this, and we're going to end up having another show. I know we are, because what we didn't get to is you actually did lose your leg.
I did. I had to go 18 months later, went back, and they just said, you know, here's the deal, Craig. You can keep it for sure, but you're not going to climb again, you're not going to bike again, and you're not going to ski again. And right. So those were the three things I wanted to do with my wife and with my kids, and I thought, okay, well, what's my option? And they said, well, you can cut your leg off. And I went, interviewed some guys who had done it, and, you know, after much prayer, much thought, much talk with Cindy, decided, okay, let's do it, and went back into the hospital, did the amputation, and then, you know, fast forward to last summer, went back into climbing very slowly. You know, at first I wasn't sure where it was going to land, but went back in and started climbing again, and then was in Yosemite last summer doing some speed ascents on El Cap with El Capitan, with an old hero of mine from my early climbing days, Hans Florin, and just realizing, wow, you know, God not only, you know, I used to lay in bed and go, God, just please heal me. And now it's like, wow, he doesn't just heal you. I mean, he steps in and just takes care of everything. It's just incredible when you just relinquish that control and go, okay, you know what, whatever's, let's do it. Let's see what happens now. And that's kind of where we are today, is just, I just want to see now, okay, let's see what God wants to do with this now
right.
and as we go forward.
Well, it's awesome, and again, we're gonna have to visit again on the air. I know you and I'll spend some time off the air together, but again, folks, go to afterthefallministry.com. You can go to my website, powerplayersradio.com, and I'll link you up there. I definitely will have more conversations with you, Craig. I hate to cut it short because there's so much more to talk about.
Oh,
But I want to thank you for coming on the program with
me
today, and we'll look forward to doing some more stuff together real soon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Hope you have a great day.
You too.
Thanks.